Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
The Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is our friend Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's back again because we can't do without him. Welcome back, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Well, we love having you. Let's start with some very important state news. Governor Hochul released her budget proposal on Wednesday. What's your initial reaction, Blair, to her spending plan?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's an easy budget for the governor in the sense that the state has a big surplus. So it's not the kind of budget where there's a sort of slash and burn element to it. That being said, the governor's plan anticipates revenue shortfalls in the next few years as the federal COVID funds dry up in New York. And so, of course, those are projections. You never know. But I think a lot of what the governor was doing in her $227 billion budget proposal is to see how much of the money she could squirrel away for reserves and to, if she could, come up with new revenue sources that are recurring so that she has more dough as she heads into the end of her first full term.
So what kind of marks is she getting? Do people think she's doing a good job? What's the deal?
Well, I mean, the polling has pretty good numbers for her. I mean, in the most recent Siena poll had her, in the high 50s, mid to high 50s in terms of public approval. And I think that is viewed by the administration as vindication of her efforts. There's always tension between the executive and legislative branches. It doesn't matter, if they're all one political party or not. We've seen it in the past where Republicans fight with Republicans and Democrats fight with Democrats. And so there will be a challenge to some of what the governor's proposed in her budget from the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party in the legislature. And the relationship between the executive and the legislative branches has become frayed, most notably over the fight over the governor's proposed chief judge nomination. Hector LaSalle was rejected by the state Senate committee. So, I think there'll be a lot of still, fighting that will go on because after all, Democrats being Democrats, that's what they do. But it's a relatively easy budget because of the significant budget surplus that the state has.
Well, you're a fairly progressive fellow. Do you think that the progressives in the state are making ground or gaining ground or losing it?
Well, it's hard to. I mean, I'm not sure how you measure that. I mean, certainly in the legislative branch, progressives have more, I think, of an impact on the state Senate side than they do on the state assembly or with the executive branch. Now, the executive branch being the governor, I mean, I think the attorney general would be considered a progressive by progressives. I think that they are ascendant in a sense. But the governor really is institutionally the most powerful player in Albany. And, you know, she's an upstate, more moderate Democrat. But you can see it reflected in the policies. I mean, earlier this month, actually now January, so I forgot what month I was in. The legislature approved a constitutional amendment for the ERA and to enshrine in the state constitution other rights. And that is an indication of a more progressive legislature than there would have been had it's still been bipartisan as it was prior to 2019.
So you were in the New York Times again, Blair. This time the issue was Governor Hochul vetoing the Grieving Families Act, arguing that Democratic lawmakers rushed passage before its impact could be fully evaluated. And this is a quote. "I think it's more evidence of a tension between the legislature and Ms. Hochul," said Blair Orner, that's you, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, which had supported the bill. "I mean, the veto message could have been written differently, but it wasn't." Mr. Horner, that's you, also noted that versions of the bill have been in Albany for more than a decade. "My guess is that if she wanted to work something out on a bill, it could have been done," you said. So can you bring us up to date on that?
Well, yeah, it's sort of an obscure provision of New York state law that looms large to families who have someone in their family who dies due to the negligence of another person. And for most people, that never happens, so nobody ever thinks about it, thankfully. But for those families that do, you know, it matters a lot. Under New York law, which was originally written in 1847 and has not been substantially changed in 175 years, if someone is killed due to the negligence of someone else, car crash, mistake in a hospital, whatever, the family is entitled to filing a lawsuit and being compensated if they win for the economic loss of that person. So if you're Alan Chartok, of course, that loss would be gigantic. If you're a measly NYPER guy, the compensation would be small. You know, so the hedge fund manager family does well. I mean, of course, under the most tragic of circumstances. But a senior citizen who dies or a child who dies, those families do poorly. Or if they're low income or, you know, relative, you can sort of figure it out. Economic loss might have made sense in 1847 when people lived on farms and it was really about a male breadwinner getting killed. It doesn't make as much sense in the 21st century. And so partly it was the change to the economic loss issue to sort of broaden it to non-economic losses, and also to change the definition of what's a family. The 1847 male breadwinner family is not the standard for America or New York in 2023. So, you know, that bill's been around. It's been kicking around for 30 years, and it's been moved out of committees and moved in different houses. And it's been this ongoing thing. Will New York modernize it? New York and Alabama were the only states that had this definition. And so finally it pops last year. And it was, you know, overwhelming bipartisan majorities, 57 votes for it in the Senate, as I recall, and 147 in the Assembly. So the governor vetoes it, but she writes in the veto message not that she has a substantive problem, which, you know, reasonable people can always have different views. She says that the legislature didn't do their job. So that's just throwing gasoline on the fire after the Hector LaSalle fight. And, I just think it makes things harder in Albany, not easier.
So what is the existing tension between the governor and the legislature at this stage? You've been around for a while. Is it worse? Is it better? What's going on?
Well, I think it can't be. It's early. I think that the legislature feels particularly emboldened. There have never been, in modern times, there have not been supermajorities of both houses, certainly of one political party. And so I think the legislature is feeling more muscular in terms of taking on an executive. The executive has vast institutional powers under the New York State Constitution, but she won in a squeaker against somebody that knows most people thought she wouldn't have been as close. And the legislature is feeling like she was, in fact, a drag on their prospects. So I think that there's the inherent institutional tension you have in American democracy, coupled with, I think, a rising feeling among the legislative branch that this is an opportunity for them to become a more equal partner with the executive And so I think that that heads to a collision. Is it worse? I mean, you know, under Governor Pataki, there was one year where Republican Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno and Democratic Assembly Sheldon Silver overrode over 100 vetoes of the governor. And so that was pretty tense. Andrew Cuomo was a rough character, and, you know, the legislature chafed under his sort of rough and tough approach to politics. Is it worse than that? I doubt it. But we'll see how the budget plays out.
So why is the governor feuding with fellow Democrats? Is she trying to establish herself as a centrist and not as a sort of typical progressive?
Well, I think the governor, you know, the governor's from upstate, Western New York area. And so, you know, her political development was shaped by those experiences. It's not the same thing as New York City or places downstate. New York City in particular tends to have a much more progressive orientation in terms of its democratic politics. I think the governor probably is shaped by that, and she probably views that she's been the person who was elected statewide, and the polling shows that people support it. So I think she probably thinks both in terms of her worldview coupled with her political instincts that what she's proposing makes the most sense. And, you know, legislators are not elected statewide, and they reflect their own constituents, which may be more left or right leaning than where the governor is. So I think it's partly that, and I think it's partly for a new governor who last year was thrust into the job to establish herself as the commanding political figure of the state.
So let me ask you this. You are my go-to guy on higher education, have been forever. So you said that outside of the major universities, both public and independent, the finances of four-year and two-year colleges are increasingly precarious. So what does that mean?
Well, the state policy under Governor Cuomo was to essentially freeze state support. And if there was any additional state support, it came out of rising tuition.
And you've spoken about that on this very program. Yes, go ahead.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, the 10-year result was drastically reduced enrollments in both the public universities at the state and New York City levels. Now, to some extent, that reflects the demographic trend of the whole country. But the when you rely more on tuition dollars to pay for the cost of college and you have drastic reductions in enrollment, unless you make up the money from somewhere other source, those colleges are in an increasingly precarious situation. Now, the university centers, particularly in SUNY, but also true of the independent universities, they tend to be more financially secure. And the four-year public colleges and four-year private colleges, frankly, plus the community colleges, have seen incredible reductions in their enrollments, some schools worse than others. And the state hasn't done anything about it. Now, last year's budget, which Governor Hochul's first, restored some of made some changes to how the state financed colleges and restored some of the funding that was needed. And this year's proposed budget more or less follows that trend. But neither last year's budget nor her proposed budget this year does anything to reverse the trend. And, you know, Cazenovia College, for example, a private school in central New York, it is closing its doors. And so now, so maybe we, you know, I mean, I talk to policymakers, sometimes they say, well, you know, we just don't have enough students. Now, that's not technically true. There are lots of people that would like to go to college. But certainly, right in the governor's proposed budget, she raises the cost again, following in the footsteps of her predecessor. And I don't see how raising the cost of something is going to increase the numbers of people going to the school. So, I think a lot of colleges are in a financial precipice, and New York should reverse that, not only because it makes perfect sense to have a more well-educated workforce and a more educated citizenry, but these little colleges, particularly in upstate New York, are often the only economic engine in the area. And if they close their doors, some communities are sunk. So we, you know, the state spends billions on Elon Musk. Why not spend it on colleges?
Well, what you say makes great sense. So why don't they do it?
Well, you know, it's public colleges are and private colleges. It's not like they can do anything, right? They can't say, well, we're going to leave the state if you don't give us more money. So their leverage in the process is limited. And on the public side, it's doubly limited in the sense that they're, you know, the government agencies, they can't fight with the executive. And so when it, in the, you know, the night of the long knives that comes with the budget, they're left with a, you know, a paperclip because they don't have the same sort of political force outside of the unions. They don't have the same political force as other entities, businesses or labor unions or whatever, that have both political muscle and or economic leverage that they could leave.
Blair Horner, let's talk about a column you recently wrote about doing more to avert climate catastrophe. What do you got in mind?
Well, I guess everyone hears about it so much, it sort of like fades into the background noise of people's lives. But I just will bring to all of our listeners' attention here, the planet is heating up, and we are on pace for a catastrophic change in the world's climate, which could easily lead to the end of civilization as we know it. And I know that those are all strong words, but that's what the experts say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, New York and California and some of the, you know, about a dozen of the states in the country, like, they understand science and they're taking steps to deal with it. A lot of states aren't. The federal government's gridlocked because of ideological differences in Washington. And so, you know, you can't let up on this thing. I mean, it's going to be bad. We can see it. If anybody is a skier knows that, you know, the people who run ski operations have to produce more snow on their own because it's too warm. And rising sea levels are real, and they're going to be they're going to cost, you know, a lot of money for shorelines and mass transit systems in New York City, and roadways are going to be more devastated through intense storms. All of that's going to cost a ton of money to deal with. And so one of the issues that we think should be on the table in New York is, well, who pays for that? Right now, it's set up that you pay and I pay. And we think it should be the oil companies. That would make a big difference. And we think New York should take aggressive moves to further curtail the use of fossil fuels, like its plan is. The state has a plan to phase it all out. And you got to meet those goals. You know, it's easy for policymakers and elected officials to say, oh, yeah, we're going to make all these goals in 10, 20, 30 years from now. But it's hard to make it happen. And you can't wait to the last minute. It's not like a term paper.
Yeah, I remember those days. So how come it's not happening? In other words, what's the problem?
Well, you know, it's the steps to take it are enormous. There's a lot of things that have to happen simultaneously. New York State has a blueprint report that came out in December from the Climate Action Council, which was established under the law to come up with a game plan to meet the legal goals set by the state in 2019. So it's a complicated thing. You're asking people to make changes in their lives. And for opponents who are, you know, either ideologically opposed or just shilling for the fossil fuel industry, they run around and it's easy to cherry pick something and get everybody revved up. And so the one thing you hear about is they're coming for your gas stove, right? Which of course is ludicrous. But what the proposal is that going forward, new buildings won't rely on gas for power. They'll just have electricity, and future appliances like future cars will be powered by electricity, not by fossil fuels. And so instead you have people running around, you know, to get everyone revved up, to undermine the science, to undermine the policies around, you know, sort of propaganda moves to get people revved up on like gas stoves. So it's just ridiculous, but it has a political impact. And it makes it harder to do things that we have to do to avoid a dystopian future.
Blair Horner is with us today, as he often is, thank goodness, on healthcare. Hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers still lack access to one of the most basic rights, one to healthcare. The governor's proposal expands existing programs to provide additional coverage, but that still leaves too many New Yorkers without coverage. What do you got to say about that?
You said it best. You know, I mean, if the pandemic has taught us anything, it's that everyone needs to have health care. And it shouldn't be because your employer offers you lousy care or no care, or you don't have enough money, even with subsidies to pay for it, or you just decide to gamble because you're young. That shouldn't be the way the system is set up. No other developed society does that. And as a result, you can see in America that the longevity, the lifespan of Americans is far below these other developed countries. And so it's just sort of a nutty way to go about things. There's all of these various band-aids, and there are good programs. The sort of the Obamacare equivalent at the state level exists and does a good job of offering health insurance and has dropped New York's uninsured rate to, around 5%. But that still leaves a lot of people out. And some of them are people that are, immigrants or undocumented immigrants. And so it's, it doesn't make any sense from a sort of a normal grown-up societal perspective to have people running around with inadequate health insurance or none, where they have to make decisions on whether or not they go because they have a cough. They're afraid that, the massive deductible that they have is too high, and they don't want to, they can't afford the $2,000 deductible, so they don't go, and then they end up with something more significant. So the governor, she has in her budget, she has more funding for all these programs. That's great. She has in her budget some proposals to sort of to improve the state's what's the so-called charity care, where hospitals are compensated by the state for covering patients who can't pay their bills. So there's good things that are happening, but ultimately, New York and America should give the same rights to everyone under the age of 65. The people that are 65 and older have.
Blair Horner, from your perch at NYPIRG, I know that NYPIRG is supporting the governor's plan to hike cigarette taxes.
Well, the governor's proposed cigarette tax hike is $1 a pack. The last time it went up was over a dozen years ago. And, so you just, in fact, factored the current tax for inflation. It would be higher, actually, than what she's proposing. And so to us, it makes sense. I mean, there's significant shortfalls. She doesn't increase the equivalent increase for other tobacco products. So does that mean now the people that smoke cigarettes are going to start smoking pipe tobacco or whatever, right? I mean, is that the governor also proposes to ban the sale of flavored tobacco products, which makes sense because virtually everybody who starts smoking starts with something that is flavored to reduce the harshness of inhaling smoke, which of course, when you say those words, you understand why people want it flavored. But, she doesn't do anything about increasing the state's funding for programs to help smokers to quit, for example. She doesn't have anything, as far as I can tell yet anyway, about increasing oversight of tackling the illegal sale, bootlegging sale of cigarettes, for example. She doesn't do any of the sort of the other side of the equation, and we'll be pushing for those things to be included.
Did you ever smoke?
I was never a regular smoker of anything, but yes, in my 60, going on 69 years of rotating the sun, I have in my youth.
Well, you're a piker compared to my 81.
It's not a race, Alan. It's not a race.
No. As my mother would point out to my twin brother and myself, everything doesn't have to be a competition. Okay, so New York State offers its own people's court for New York consumers who get ripped off by unscrupulous businesses and landlords. What's that about? And we have about 3 minutes.
Yeah, people probably would recognize this if they watched the show on TV, the people's court shows that existed. Under New York law, there are courts that are created for sort of the low cost conflicts, usually around financial disputes. And so instead of having to go out and hire a lawyer, a regular person can represent themselves in small claims court. That's the name of it in New York. And different parts of the state have different maximums about how much you can go in for, $5,000, $10,000, depends on where you live. But it's the basic concept is the same. And the hard thing, of course, is, most people, they don't go to small claims courts, so they may go once in their whole life, if ever. And, how do you know how to do that? So my organization offers free, non-legal procedural advice for people who want to, who want to use the service. And they can go to our website, NYPIRG.org, and click on a button and somebody will get back to them. But there also should be reforms in place to make it easier for people to collect even when they win, which is one of the big issues. And so we'll be, you know, going to be looking at that issue as well as the budget unfolds, because the judiciary budget is one of the issues that the legislature will tackle, and that's where small claims court lives.
Blair Horner, we only have a minute now. I want to ask you this. As you know, Charlie is still riding on the MTA. So the finances of the MTA are so bad that it may lead to a crisis, not only for the agency, but the state as well. Could you fill us in a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the MTA is heading toward a fiscal cliff. The governor recognized it in her budget. She came up with various ways to bolster the finances of New York. I mean, New York City can't function without a mass transit system that functions.
Right.
And the pandemic has hurt it, and the finances are bad. The state has to do more. The governor has some proposals, but some of it relies on casino revenues that don't even exist yet. And so it's important that the state tackle that, because otherwise the rest of the state's on the hook. And we've seen this play before. 40 years ago, it was a combination of New York City finances, MTA finances, which brought the entire state to the fiscal cliff.
Blair Horner, we are out of time, which is terrible, because I love talking to you. Our guest, everybody, has been Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, N-Y-P-I-R-G. Blair, as always, thanks for keeping an eye on all of this for the rest of us who don't do it enough. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or just schedule a podcast anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. Thanks for listening.